So, Danielle, are you saying that women are actually programmed to be promiscuous? Am I hearing that correctly?
You are hearing me correctly.
That's news to me.
It's funny that it's so difficult to get our minds around that, I think.
Hi, everyone. Gee, Kathy, we have a great show lined up today.
We sure do. First, a heartwarming story of how abandoned dogs help heal those with mental health issues.
Then, the must-dos to retiring happy. You'll want to take notes on this one.
Barbara, does your boomer dude know what you really want?
Ooh, I'm blushing already.
And that's not a hot flash.
Plus, a cartoon animator and toy maker shoots the breeze with us babes. As a seasoned search and rescue team member a decade ago, Susanna Charlson came across a grisly search. She struggled for months with post-traumatic stress disorder until her search and rescue partner, a once abandoned dog named Puzzle, made the surprising difference in her own healing.
Inspired by her experience, Susanna saw the possibilities in abandoned dogs and their incredible power to offer daily support and comfort to people with invisible disabilities. In her latest book, The Possibility Dogs, Susanna Charlson chronicles her journey as a psychiatric service dog trainer and explores the fascinating and developing role of canine companions in the mental health field. Welcome to the show, Susanna.
Thank you so much.
Now, I can't wait to hear this story, but first of all, you've got to tell us, does the name reflect a missing piece in your life?
Kathy's so deep, Susanna.
Yes. Well, Puzzle, my search and rescue golden retriever, who is now 9 and still working very hard, when she came to me, I was wanting a name that would resonate with children because so many of our searches involve missing children. And when we find them, they are always so frightened and afraid of being in trouble, et cetera. And so to have a friendly, light-faced golden retriever named Puzzle find them, and when they learn her name, they sort of light up.
Oh, that's nice.
So, Susanna, we said initially you were working on search and rescue missions, and then you shifted to working with psychiatric service dogs. How did that shift come about?
Well, it's not only a shift, but I would also say it's a coincident move because I actually still do work search and rescue. But it was search and rescue that provoked my interest in dogs that serve the human heart and mind and spirit. Certainly the most direct situation that I had happen was in 2003 on a search that we already knew was going to be terrible and difficult and hard in the human sense and was very much human tragedy. While we were out, I was working with a young deputy in Texas, and we stumbled upon what I think must have been the abandoned remnants of a dog fighting ring.
Oh.
And the bait dogs that they had been using, they had just left to die.
Mm.
And what we found was a scene of just palpable cruelty. Probably 30 or 40 dogs who had been left to die of starvation and exposure. And it affected both me, certainly, and the young deputy that was with me. And within about 9 months, I saw effects and responses in myself that were certainly symptomatic of PTSD. It took a while. I kept thinking I could tough through it, and it took a while, and I spoke to counselors who agreed with that. And it was a pretty dark period in my own time because I became very, very anxious about the safety of my own dogs at home, and that's where it was really focused, was this sense of when I leave, what could happen to them if someone, say, broke in or whatever. And not only did I ultimately work with counselors on this, but I was also training Puzzle, my search and rescue puppy, who was going to be my new partner. And I noticed that in working with her, my big difficulty was leaving the house. I was afraid that every time I locked the door, it didn't really lock, and so I would check it and recheck it and recheck it and recheck it. And Puzzle, the puppy being trained, was not really very patient with my sort of compulsive rechecking of locks. And I remember that there was a point that I thought, if we're going to do good work together, this dog and I. If we're going to grow forward, I've got to let this go. I've got to let this anxiety go, or I'll catch her in it, and this is a dog who could save lives.
That is so wonderful. So obviously, because of this experience, you really, instead of going to breeders to find suitable service dogs, you go to shelters to really rescue. So why do you go that route? Is it because, obviously, of your past?
I've always had a heart for rescue, and in Scent of the Missing, actually, my first book about working with Puzzle, the Golden, I made a note in there that I said, you know, I think my second search and rescue dog will probably be a rescue, because I understand now the traits that we need for this kind of work. And I just know that the population of really wonderful dogs in rescue is enormous, and these are loving, worthy animals who deserve a chance. And I also know, having worked with plenty of rescued dogs in the search field, as well as now having met plenty of rescued dogs working service, that there's a tremendous amount of talent and potential sitting in our shelters and sitting in our area rescues. And I thought it would just be a win-win situation to move forward identifying those great dogs and forming partnerships that were mutually life-saving.
So say you're in a shelter and there's all these adorable dogs around you.
You want to take them all home?
Yes. But what qualities do you look for in a dog when evaluating them for therapy work?
Well, for service work or therapy work, and therapy comfort work is that reflects those dogs that go out into the community after, say, crisis and comfort, you know, after the tornadoes or after the bombing in Boston. Comfort and therapy dogs really serve a wider population, and service dogs serve a single individual. But when I am evaluating a potential dog candidate, much of what I look for in either sense is the same, and that is I love the dogs that give soft, friendly eye contact. They're very engaged. They're very perked, and the eyes are happy to look into your face, and they're not wary or hard or hostile.
What about doggies that happen to like feet?
Who happened to like feet?
Susanna, she's asking about her own dogs, and trust me, you would not want them on your service. No offense. They're adorable.
I'm wondering if they could be, what is it,
rehabilitated? I don't think so.
Well, it's funny that you would mention that, because in the possibility dogs, there is a foot moment. Jake Piper, who is really the hero of the book, the abandoned dying puppy, that shows up on my doorstep and is trained for service. Jake, you know, in his raw youth, really adored kissing women's feet.
Oh.
And we had to redirect him away from that loving and well-intentioned activity, because obviously for a service dog, that is inappropriate. But you know, there is the occasional time we will sit down and he'll go into his beautiful downstay in a restaurant and a woman will walk by in sandals and he looks longingly at her like, I would so kiss your ankle if I could.
Well, I hate to say it, mine likes to kind of bite.
He likes to bite.
Oh,
yeah.
my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. But he's adorable.
You don't want to be alone in a room with him, let me put it that way.
Like little piranhas, like those little feet that says little fish.
Yes.
This is the Two Boomer Babes, and we are talking with Susanna Charlson about the role of canine companions in the mental health field. Her book is called The Possibility Dogs.
Susanna, are there certain breeds that are better suited for therapy work than others?
It's really about temperament and about finding the dogs that have joy in interacting with multiple numbers of people. And those therapy and comfort dogs perform no small service, because they will, you know, they will greet and give affection to all comers, and that's pretty exhausting work. And you know, the beautiful thing is, I know comfort therapy dogs that weigh 2 pounds and make their rounds in a basket in hospitals, and I know comfort therapy dogs that are 135 pounds. So, you know, the field is wide open, and we see in comfort therapy work too a real role for senior dogs, for special needs dogs that are blind and deaf. I have a 16-year-old blind and deaf terrier chihuahua mix who is in the book, saved right before his scheduled euthanasia, and he de-escalates anxious children.
Oh.
There's something very serene about his presence, and he calms anxious children in a way that that a younger dog might not, which is really pretty magical. Now, for service work, again, there's a lot of breeds that can do it, and much depends on what the task is that's needed. So if, for instance, somebody has disorientation episodes with balance issues, you might need a dog who is really, really got some good nose, a retriever mix, perhaps, that also has some height, because you're going to need some stability for the human partner, and you're going to need a dog that can be trained to locate home, for instance, or locate an outdoor exit. And those are really very suitable often to, say, retrievers.
Well, you know, I can understand how you can teach a dog to do a very specific task for a person with, say, a physical disability, like helping a blind person, you know, navigate the streets. But how on earth do you train a dog to help a person with a psychiatric issue? You know, say, obsessive-compulsive disorder where they're checking the stove 100 times.
Right. Well, you know, in many ways, it's very similar to things we're used to seeing service dogs do. What we do is we teach the dog, when you see this, when you see X, do Y. So, for instance, a dog that assists someone who can't see, you know, is trained to block someone who, for instance, nearly steps off of a step that they don't know is there, or could step into traffic, and the dog will literally block or check their way. And so it's the same thing. If you've got somebody who compulsively checks the stove, you know, you teach the dog, okay, two checks of the stove, that's a good safety measure, but if I go back to it, or this person goes back to it and back to it and back to it, on the third and fourth event, intercede. Hmm. Block them from that behavior. And no two handlers necessarily need the same blocking maneuver. For some, they need the dog to literally sit in front of them, perhaps sit on their foot. Some need a paw at the knee. Some need a little soft woof. You know, the redirection moment can be very different, but it is essentially very individualized. You know, this is the behavior we want to alert to. We want you to alert to and redirect. And so you just teach them what the behavior is and then how they need to respond, and you reward them for doing that.
This is so cool, because I can hardly get my dogs to sit and give me their little paw, their big paw. But Susanna, we're almost out of time, but quickly tell us about your nonprofit organization that you just recently started, called the Possibility Dogs.
Well, Possibility Dogs Incorporated, we assist handlers who are seeking to owner co-train, to custom train their service partners for their individual conditions. We provide training resources and curricula and access to formal testing so that these owner trainers can come out of the process of working with their dog very, very proud of the journey they've made and absolutely partnered in a very reliable way, reliable on the side of the dog and reliable from them in benefiting the dog as well. So it's a really maintained, grounded partnership and supported by, you know, strong curriculum and testing and that kind of thing.
Sounds like a great organization. We're going to put it on our website.
Oh, lovely.
Susanna Charlson, service dog trainer and author of The Possibility Dogs, thanks so much for sharing this very inspiring story.
Well, thank you very much.
Up next, important decisions to make before you retire. We'll be right back.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
In his 20-year stint as a Washington Post financial reporter and then writer of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated Retirement Journal column, Stan Hinden thought he had his own retirement all worked out. And things were going really well until his wife became ill. Despite his expertise in the world of finance, Stan Hinden's best-laid retirement plans weren't enough to fully prepare him when life intervenes and undoes them all.
Now in his 80s and going strong, Stan shares his experiences and lessons learned in the newest edition of his bestseller, How to Retire Happy, the 12 most important decisions you must make before you retire. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Stan.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be with you.
Stan, so many people are nearing or approaching or getting ready, you know, to retire, but they've taken a tremendous financial hit. And they really maybe can't afford to retire. So how do we figure out if we can afford to do it?
Well, it's a matter of simple arithmetic, and it's not that simple, but basically, what you have to do, and I would recommend that people do this a few years before they actually retire, and that is to sit down and draw up a trial budget, a retirement budget, actually. And what you do is simply on one side of the page list all of the items of income that you expect to receive in retirement, such as perhaps a pension, your Social Security, maybe income from some of your investments, whatever you think you're going to have on a regular basis in terms of income, I would list that. And then on the other side of the page, I would list your current living expenses. You compare that number to your income. And if your expenses are more than your income, then you've got some work to do. It is not easy these days, as you know, to get income from your investments because money market funds and CDs pay almost nothing at all. And so you've got to find other places to invest, perhaps with a relatively low risk. One of the popular items these days is dividends and dividend companies, companies that are good companies, solid companies, been around for many, many years, pay regular dividends and have paid them for many years, and some often pay rising dividends. And so that's perhaps one way to use your assets, your money, to get some income.
And you're talking about those blue chip stocks.
Yes, in one sense, that would be.
Okay. But
the other thing is that if that's still not going to close the gap, you might have to go back to work, at least part-time, to help out and to help your retirement budget. So that's one of the approaches. The worst part of the problem may be that you look at your expenses and they're way out of line with your income. So you're going to have to cut your expenses. I've tried that. It's a very hard thing to do, and I have sympathy for anybody who's in that situation. But some people even move to another town or to another state where the cost of living is lower, and that's, you know, a possibility as well. But before you go into retirement, you've got to have your income and your expenses in balance so you don't run out of money. And we know that retirement can last 20 years or more, and so you've got to be in reasonably good financial shape when you finally stop getting your regular paycheck and start living off your assets.
Right, because we're going to live a long life. Well, Stan, another tricky one is when we should apply for Social Security. And my husband actually just retired at a younger age, and we have this ongoing discussion all the time. So is it true that we should wait as long as we can before taking it?
I would say this. If when you reach the age of 70, at that point in your life, when and you are retired, and you think you will need the largest Social Security check that you can get, then it would be recommended to not take your Social Security until 70. Because let's say your full retirement age is 66, when you could get your full Social Security retirement check. If you wait those extra 4 years between 66 and 70, you will get an 8% increase per year in your check, a total of 32% over that period of time. Now, admittedly, you have to have enough money to go through the years until you're 70 so that it will last, then you'll, you know, be able to live comfortably. Many people take their Social Security at age 62, which is the earliest you can take it. But I believe that many people take it because they simply need the money. And, you know, that's not terrible, but if that's the case, then that's certainly understandable. But those payments are reduced if you take it real early. And the way to get the biggest payment is to wait to 70. So there's a lot of things to think about, including what your health is, you know, what the health of your family members are, and, you know, how long you might expect to live, and in what physical condition. Those are all considerations that people have to think about before they actually decide when they're going to take their Social Security.
We are speaking with financial writer Stan Hinden about important decisions to make before we retire for a happy retirement. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
As a follow-on to our series, Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's, we'd like to let our listeners know about a new app developed by the University of Illinois at Chicago about dementia. The Dementia Guide mobile app has screening questions, resources, and management tips, which can provide invaluable information for caregivers and loved ones of persons with dementia.
The developers are looking for non-professionals to test the Dementia Guide mobile app and provide feedback. If interested in participating, please contact Dr. Valerie Gruss at 312-413-9000 or email vgruss, that's V-G-R-U-S-S, at uic.edu.
This is Kathy and Barb, the two Boomer Babes. Joining us is Stan Hinden, a former financial reporter and columnist for the Washington Post and author of How to Retire Happy.
Well, I got to ask you, what hope is there for the rest of us if you, as a financial reporter for all those years, were kind of blindsided in retirement? I mean, there's a lesson for us all, isn't there?
Well, yes. It was very difficult for me to understand that even though I had been a financial writer, that when it came to retirement, I actually knew very little, if anything, about Social Security, Medicare, Medigap, all of the pension subjects that one really needs to know about before you retire. And I quickly figured out that if I didn't know any of those things, perhaps many other people didn't know either and were not prepared for retirement in the way that essentially I was not prepared. So that's why I decided to write the book.
And Stan, this really hit you. You really recognized that you weren't prepared for retirement when your wife became ill. Can you tell us what happened?
Oh, yes. A few years ago, my wife, Sarah, and she and I have now been married for 60 years. So a few years ago, she began to develop dementia, and the doctors said that she had, come down with Alzheimer's disease. It was very surprising because she'd been a very active person. She was an executive at the General Electric Company, and she did all the things that they say you should do to prevent Alzheimer's. And but still in all, she still was diagnosed with that problem. She now lives in a group home where she gets 24-hour care, and that's been very good for her, I think, and certainly been able to give her better care under those circumstances. But that is a very, very difficult situation, as you will understand, when your spouse, to whom you've been married for many years, becomes ill, and you're confronted with an illness where the doctors simply do their best, but eventually just shrug their shoulders and say, you know, we don't have any medications that will cure Alzheimer's, and we hardly have any medications that will delay it, let alone cure it. So that's the hardest part of all.
Right. Well, Stan, so you had to redo really your whole retirement plan. And let's get to some of the important decisions that you say we must make, that you learned from this experience we must make before we retire. First off, we should figure out if we're really ready to retire. But how do we do that? How do we know if we're ready to retire?
You have to consider the various aspects of retirement. Some people are ready to retire. They just had it with work. They're tired of their jobs. They're looking for free time and a sort of an easier lifestyle. Another reason to retire is that you feel that you've worked for 20 or 30 years and maybe more, and you're getting to the age where you really want to do something else and you want time for yourself. So that's another good reason to retire. One good reason not to retire is that you're still healthy, you're still active, and feel that you would like to continue to work. Many people like to continue to work because they like the people they work with. They like the atmosphere in their offices or workplaces. They have friends there, and they don't want to give them up because when you retire and you're finally home all alone and all your colleagues and friends are back at the office, you suddenly realize, well, you miss them. In my case, I found that after I retired for a short time there before I start writing the new column, it wasn't all the deadlines and the hard work I missed. It was my workplace.
Well, Stan Hinden, financial writer, columnist, and author of How to Retire Happy, thanks so much for sharing your terrific advice with the Two Boomer Babes.
Up next, what do women want? Adventures in the study of female desire. In our post-feminist anti-sexism world, when it comes to libido, men may be viewed as naturally driven to act on their lust and think later. But on the other hand, women may be seen as craving emotional connections and as defenders of monogamy.
In a 2009 New York Times Magazine story, award-winning journalist Daniel Bergner posed this question: what if our fundamental beliefs about women and sex were wrong? This sparked a firestorm from readers, and his article still ranks among the most read in the publication's history.
In his new book, What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire, Daniel Bergner explores what it is that stokes a woman's fire, so to speak, and what keeps them glowing in bed. Daniel joins us from Brooklyn, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So I must ask, why did you want to research women's libido? Do you have a personal interest in the subject, Daniel?
Well, how could any man, or at least any straight man, not have a personal interest? But really, you know, this began 8 years ago for me in the lab of a researcher, Meredith Chivers, who was studying female desire, who, as she put it, was shaking the foundations of the way we think about women's sexuality. And that could sound really arrogant, egotistical from a scientist, but in her case, very accurate. And it just made me want to stay with her research, talk to more researchers, and speak to lots of women, which I ultimately did, about their sexual lives so that I could thread their stories through the book.
Sounds like a great job.
Yeah,
for
well,
a man.
A lot better than covering, like, say, the garbage dump or something.
it was fascinating. And I hope it just sparks a new conversation about sexuality, about who we are as human beings.
Well, it certainly has among us babes. Now, you must have really gained a lot of info from your huge outpouring of response from your article. What were some of your favorites?
Well, it's interesting. The outpouring of response to the article, which, as you said, ranks as the most read in the New York Times Magazine's history, really led me to rethink some assumptions that we have been fed and that we've kind of lived by for so very long. So starting with, we've been told that men are programmed by evolution to spread their seed, to be promiscuous, and women, by comparison, to seek out one good man and to be relatively monogamous, naturally. How convenient is that for men? How comforting is that for me? And, you know, the more I looked at the original academic papers that led to that understanding, the flimsier the evidence seemed, and the more I spent time with the researchers, most of them women, doing experiments, doing studies now, the more a new understanding, and I think a really empowering understanding of female desire emerges.
So, Daniel, are you saying that women are actually programmed to be promiscuous? Am I hearing that correctly?
You are hearing me correctly.
That's news to me.
It's funny that it's so difficult to get our minds around that. I think partly that has to do with fear, male fear particularly. But yes, women are at least as programmed to be promiscuous as men are. I'll give you a couple quick examples, and there are many in the book. So back to Meredith Chivers for a sec. She compares what women say turns them on to what their bodies say using a little device called a plethysmograph. And take a handsome stranger on the one hand, take an equally hunky, trusted close friend on the other. Women say the trusted close friend turns them on, thus conforming to our societal scripts. But their bodies say something else entirely. Their bodies respond very strongly to that handsome stranger. And I should caution, this doesn't mean that the plethysmograph can tell us everything about desire. But it is a wake-up call that our old constructions may not be that accurate. So one other quick example, study of 2,500 couples, a lot of couples, no fluke in the results. Desire between men and women starts out around the same point, so there's no issue of women's libidos being lower than men's. But the male desire kind of declines gradually over time. The female desire seems to plummet, and again, it just turns our assumptions upside down.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with award-winning journalist and author Daniel Bergner about women's sexual desire and what we really want in the sack, that is. His new book is called What Do Women Want?
Daniel, why historically have men been viewed as the ones that, you know, want to run around and have affairs while we women are just at home kind of taking care of things?
Again, I can't help but think that it's soothing to men, and of course also it's comforting socially because it makes at least half the population into a natural kind of social glue that's all about emotional closeness, all about keeping things together while the men get to be the anarchic ones. Now, I'll give you another example of just how pervasive and powerful that assumption has been. So even though the book is mostly about women, I did spend some time looking at our close primate ancestors. So I went down to a primatology center. It turns out that until very recently, you know, we've been told that male monkeys, the aggressors in war, male monkeys, the aggressors, initiators in sex. But if you take the blinders off, if you look closely, as I did side by side with primatologists, it's completely reversed. Females are the aggressors in war, in fact, and females are the initiators in sex. They're stalking their sexual prey. They are leaving their babies unattended to go out and get sex. And the funniest part, if you can call it funny, how we've blinded ourselves, is that primatologists have to cycle out, get rid of the males every few years because the females get too bored to have sex with them. So again, it's sort of like, how did even scientists miss this for so long? And I think the only explanation is that, you know, what we want to see, we see. And maybe now my argument is we're ready to see something more candidly.
Well, that experiment really piqued my interest because I was wondering, how would you know that these women, not these women, these monkeys,
Barbara,
these women monkeys, It just seems natural in nature that they want to propagate the species. How do you know that this is desire, that they really want to have sex with these other monkeys? I mean, are they wearing negligees, or do they have a come-hither look? How do you know this?
That is such a good question. I was just thinking about how to explain that quickly. But maybe the simplest explanation is the best. So if you think about it, a monkey probably cannot think, and I could tell you the same story about rats. So we're pretty sure a rat is not thinking, I want to have a baby now, or I'd like to have another child now. That isn't really how evolution works. It works built on immediate gratification. So the monkey is driven by desire for pleasure. As a species, this is the way it propagates, but each individual monkey is going after what it wants. And in the case of the monkey character that I actually follow among all my women characters, this little monkey named Deidre, she's going after her man and leaving her baby to scoot after her if it can keep up, while she, Deidre, goes out and gets the sex that she wants.
Well, Daniel, she probably leaves those little babies because she has an au pair back in her little roost.
And I'm also wondering if you looked at menopausal monkeys, what they did.
Yeah. Did they have hot flashes?
Did they run after those male monkeys like the younger ones did?
Here's a really interesting thing. The answer is no. I don't know about menopausal monkeys.
That's another book.
But here's what's so interesting. So we often associate menopause with a decline in women's desire. And there's no question there are some physical effects there that play a role. But there's an Australian researcher who's followed thousands of women now over 20-year periods, so throughout their sexual lives. And what she is absolutely certain of looking at the data is that change in hormones is trumped almost, consistently. I shouldn't say almost consistently. It is trumped consistently by a new partner. So give the woman, even after menopause, the new partner, and desire spikes.
Ooh. Well, we've both been married almost 30 years or more. We'll have to tell our husbands your little tidbit and see what they think.
I don't want to cause any trouble. And seriously, I'm in a monogamous relationship. What I'm talking about isn't tossing out monogamy. It's having a more honest conversation with each other, which is what I hope the book will do. And I'll just give you an example. I spent time and tell the story of a 30-year-old woman who's trying to decide whether to marry, and she's tormented by the decision about whether to marry her boyfriend, who's adoring, he's attractive, he's perfect on paper, but she's lost her desire for him. And I always thought this would be a less tormenting decision if you could have, first, a really candid set of conversations with your partner, and second of all, if she didn't feel so abnormal, if she didn't feel like by not being desirous within her monogamous relationship, she was somehow betraying the genetic code of women. She's not. This is absolutely normal.
Well, tell us very quickly about that experiment you wrote about where the college co-eds were wired to a lie detector, and then they were asked how many sexual partners they had had. I found that fascinating.
Yes. So a large group of women were assembled, and half of them answered questions about their sexual lives when they thought that a fellow student might be able to read over their answers, when they thought things weren't going to be confidential. Another set were wired to what they thought was a working polygraph machine. Well, the women who worried that their answers wouldn't be kept confidential answered a very low number of sexual partners. And the women who thought they would be caught in any lie answered 70% higher. Do the same experiment with men. The answers are consistent or the same in either condition. And the point the researcher made to me was that 70% difference just shows that still in our society, women are given far less permission to be sexual than men are.
Well, Daniel Bergner, author of What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. This has been truly enlightening, and thanks so much for sharing it with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Up next, from meanie babies to heads, this boomer dude's got it covered. Stay with us.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
As a follow-on to our series, Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's, we'd like to let our listeners know about a new app developed by the University of Illinois at Chicago about dementia. The Dementia Guide mobile app has screening questions, resources, and management tips, which can provide invaluable information for caregivers and loved ones of persons with dementia.
The developers are looking for non-professionals to test the Dementia Guide mobile app and provide feedback. If interested in participating, please contact Dr. Valerie Gruss at 312-413-9000 or email vgruss, that's V-G-R-U-S-S, at uic.edu.
Kathy, do you remember The Muppets and The Simpsons?
I love The Muppets and I love The Simpsons. We still watch it every night.
Who creates these characters? Who draws the cartoons and who makes it all come together?
And what about toys? Who invents those things anyway? And how does some take off like crazy and others become collectibles? Like, remember those stupid Beanie Babies our girls used to have?
Yes, I do. I hated those things, but my favorite were the Meanie Babies. They were hysterical and so much more fun than the Beanie Babies.
Well, it's a good thing that our next guest just happens to know all the answers behind these questions. Tim Young has worked right alongside the creative minds behind these brands. This boomer dude was the artist in residence who created the original animation models, premium toys, limericks, artistic set designs, and more.
So today, Tim's creativity is still very hard at work. His latest book, I Hate Picture Books, is getting rave reviews, and his soon-to-be release toy Heads will be available this spring in toy stores. Tim joins us in our studios to shoot the breeze with us babes. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. Hi.
Tim, talk about those Meanie Babies that Barbara was referring to.
Well, they were a lot of fun. I was design director for a company called the Idea Factory, and we got to basically play all day designing these wacko characters that were making fun of Beanie Babies. And I got to create characters like Splat, the roadkill cat, who's got a tire track across his back.
And he's very flat.
He is a bit flat. And Heartless Bear, who has a kind of a hole throughout his chest. Lucky the Rabbit, who's missing a foot.
Okay, so you got to read us the limerick for Lucky the Rabbit.
Sure. It's Lucky's so mad he's insane. He has every right to complain. He'd like to kick rump, but he can't with a stump because his foot is someone's keychain.
Isn't that awful?
Sick, but wonderful.
Thank you. Love it.
Okay, so read us the one about the Heartless Bear. That's my favorite.
Okay. This is a Valentine's Meanie, so I need your glasses.
Sure. Oh, this is so funny. You are really a boomer dude. This boomer dude needs glasses.
He does. I will. All right, now I'm ready. I never loved you from the start, and now I'm afraid we must part. You said with a grin as you reached right on in and yanked out my still beating heart.
Oh,
love it. Yeah. Well, you have had some amazing experience and you have worked with some of the greats like Jim Henson. What was your all-time favorite gig?
I've just had such a long, fun career jumping from really neat place to work to really neat place to work. And it's hard to pick a favorite. I've just got so many.
Well, and now you have a really cool, really fun new children's book out called I Hate Picture Books. And he's such a cute little ornery guy that's on the cover. Is he sort of a Tim reinvented?
Well, he's kind of parts of me, but he's not fully me because I never really hated my books. But I completely understand what he's going through because he gets angry because his books are telling him to do silly things.
Well, Tim, have you had any potential lawsuits? Because you use a lot of other books within your own new book.
It's called Fair Use because I'm using parody to make a point, to make an editorial point about children's books.
And I bet it's great advertising for those authors as well.
Oh, it is. What I really appreciate is a lot of the reviews have said, oh, well, my child found a bunch of the books that are in your book on their shelves and went and pulled them out and looked at them again. So it is kind of neat to remind people of some of these great books.
You have a new toy out, which is about to be launched, actually, called Heads.
Right.
Tell us about the Heads.
Well, Heads, H-E-D-Z-Z, is it's a line of characters that are all they're balls. They're round shape. They're just really kind of wacky characters that are doing silly things. Like one is called Seafood, who's got his tongue sticking out, has a bit of food on it. Another one's called Underwear, who has underwear on his head.
Well, Tim Young, author of I Hate Picture Books and creator of the soon-to-be-released toy Heads, thanks so much for sharing all of this amazing creativity. And you just keep on trucking. You are an inspiration to us babes.
Well, thank you.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Do you ever wonder why some people spend countless hours and blood, sweat, and tears making something by hand when they could just go out and buy it at a store? Our next guest has something to say about that.
Peter Korn has been a furniture maker for the past 40 years and is the author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. He joins us to shoot the breeze about the value of craft in our increasingly digitalized and fast-paced world. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Peter, what's the attraction of making things by hand in our completely mass-produced world?
Well, I think people are interested in craftsmanship and practicing it themselves because there's some level of satisfaction, meaning, and fulfillment that they hope to find in that that they're not finding in ordinary life.
Okay, so Peter, tell us about the process. Say you're about to make a piece of furniture and you're looking at raw planks of wood. Tell us about your creative process.
Well, for myself, and it differs from person to person, I'll start off with a design brief, which is to say I know what I'm trying to make. It could be a chair. And then I'll go through a process of sketching, which is a quick way of looking at ideas and working through them and not getting too stuck on them. And then when I find a sketch that sings to me and really appeals, I'll refine it through full-scale drawings and test it with models and mock-ups. So that by the time I invest weeks and weeks in building the finished product, I'm pretty sure it's going to work well.
But are you ever in the middle of making something you decide, hey, I'm going to go a completely different way?
If I'm going to go a completely different way, then something goes in the fire.
Oh.
I guess you're already pretty committed. But you certainly can make adjustments in the middle of a piece of furniture. You know, different art forms allow you different amounts of plasticity as you work. And with woodworking and furniture making, a lot of the creative part happens before you even pick the wood.
Peter, do you think is craft disappearing or is it really on the rebound?
I think that craft is really strong in our culture in terms of the number of people who are practicing it and drawn to it. But it's something that's disappearing in a sense off the radar as a way that you make a living or as something that's seen as an art form that has a lot of value. And I'm sorry to say that it isn't accorded much respect in that regard.
Well, I sure do enjoy, though, seeing all these wonderful craftspeople at the farmers markets. And you see these gorgeous, you know, jewelry, necklaces, I mean, anything, beautiful wood carvings. And just to see the workmanship that goes into it, it is really amazing.
Well, and we're in an age where more and more of our daily experience as individuals is virtual. We're dealing with our devices all day and our phones, all those things. And so the rewards of actually taking a real material like wood or clay or stone and making something, fashioning it, getting real feedback from it, and then seeing the result of what you do at the end of the day, for better or worse, that goes so deep to the human soul to have that experience.
Well, then, Peter, you say that craftsmanship is really an activity that connects us to others, but it always seemed like a rather solitary activity to me. But how does it connect you to others?
Well, there's many levels, but maybe the most obvious is through the things that you make. When the thing that you make goes out in the world and other people see it and respond to it, the thing you make is really the record of thousands of decisions that you made in the process of making it. And it somehow, hopefully, will communicate some of the questions you were asking in making it and the ideas you were exploring, even if they were subconscious ideas, and the book is partly about that. And from my point of view, for people who practice any craft, what we're really doing when we go into our workshops is saying, who am I and who can I become? Because we don't make a table or a chair or a pot because we need those things so much as because we expect to feel differently about ourselves or know more about who we can be by having gone through the creative process. So creative work, like craft, is really a process of asking, who am I and who can I become? And once you've asked that, you're participating in a broad cultural conversation, even on a very quiet, reserved level.
And this will even work for those of us that have absolutely no artistic talent
and can't hold a hammer or a saw?
You betcha. We have students come through our Center for Furniture Craftsmanship at all levels of experience, and every one of them leaves better able to make things than when they arrived, even though we all have differing amounts of native talent.
Well, the bar might be set really low for
it
me and Kathy.
Well, I invite you to come find out.
Okay, we'd love to. You might
we
be very frustrated. Well, Peter Korn, furniture maker and author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
For nearly a decade, we babes have produced and hosted the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour. We have been incredibly fortunate to gain wonderful, loyal listeners, not to mention the support of the many brave stations across the country that broadcast our program. Your ideas and encouragement have literally kept the show and us going and thriving, and we are beyond grateful to each and every one of you for giving us the opportunity of a lifetime.
Which brings us to our bittersweet announcement. For the past year, we've been working undercover on a novel called Perfectly Seasoned, a story of five dear friends in midlife. Warning, it's a bit spicy. Kind of like us boomer babes and boomer dudes.
We've never written a book before, but as usual, we didn't let that stop us, kind of like starting the radio show. Well, lo and behold, we've signed a contract with a major publishing house. We're over the moon thrilled and hope to turn the book into a perfectly seasoned series.
So as we often highlight on our show, we're reinventing ourselves, starting a second act, or is it our third or fourth or even fifth, and devoting ourselves to being full-time authors. As of July 1st, the show will no longer broadcast in its usual weekly manner, but will continue to be available 24/7 via podcast with a direct link on our website, twoboomerbabes.com.
So if you're counting sheep in the wee hours of the morning, tuning into our show just might bring on the Z's.
We thank you from the bottom of our babes' hearts for all the support and encouragement you've given us over the years and for joining us on our wild and crazy ride through the joys and pitfalls of middle age.
We hope you'll look for Perfectly Seasoned as it hits the stands, hopefully at the beginning of 2017, and buy a copy or two. Please continue to follow us on Facebook and at twoboomerbabes.com for updates. This is truly the next exciting chapter of our lives.
Until then,
we're the Two Boomer Babes.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.